Ken and Dolly.
You're being recorded now.
Listeners, we're talking to Jim Leahy. We've actually been chatting about his dog, but we're going to turn our attention to the subject of this interview now, which is the re-release with updates, and I'll ask you about that in a little bit, of his groundbreaking work, My Bread, The Revolutionary No Work, No Need Method. Jim is the founder of the very famous and much-loved Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City. So, anyhow, here we are again. We forgot to figure out how long ago it was when last we talked, but it's only periodic, and we vow to continue talking more frequently. Jim, what is different about this book? And it's an upgrade.
What's different about this book is that, you know, over the years there have been lots of input from many readers who've experimented with and kind of gave us some feedback or gave me some feedback. So the book has been updated to kind of reflect that. And then some of those changes, and also just this, as you know, as recipes age, they I think through practice kind of go through usually some type of improvement. The more people who get their hands on it, if you will. An innovation or two that, you know, I kind of stumbled upon, which was the use of miso paste.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah,
I love miso paste.
I love miso paste, and it just dawned on me that, you know, why couldn't I use a relatively large amount, at least replacing the total sodium for a batch of bread with miso paste? And I discovered that the bacteria that makes up miso actually acts as a catalyst for fermentation and kind of enhances and speeds up fermentation, and if used in small amounts can enhance the volume of the bread. It's like a ready-made dough improver, natural dough improver.
Nice.
And your dog knew that. That's why he's telling you about it.
Yes. Holly is extremely excited about the use of miso. Definitely in store.
Well, you know, I was made a little note in my head to tell you, you went from studio art to baking and
yes.
food, right? I was an art historian
uh-huh.
who went into food. Ruth Reichel actually went to the same master's program as I did at the University of Michigan, and she went from art history to food. There has to be some correlation here.
I think maybe in a weird kind of way, there is. You know, my correlation very specifically apart from, you know, at the tender age of 18 coming to Manhattan to study at School of Visual Arts, And then living in an Egyptian neighborhood in New Jersey City, the western slope facing Newark, all of a sudden I started being exposed to different kinds of foods that I had never had before growing up, you know, in a suburban neighborhood in Long Island, Mineola.
Uh-huh.
But so that was eye opening, and then of course youth in New York City. You're curious. You want to see all the different things that are out there. You know, the East Village, right back then, was like the epicenter of everything happening, in part because things are so affordable for students. So I remember like Indian food on 6th Street way back when it was just like one giant Indian restaurant with a bunch of different storefronts. No, I think it's like many different smaller Indian restaurants on 6th Street. So that, you know, and also it was just So anyway, art school brought me to desire to travel to Italy to study art history and the language. And because I went to Italy at the tender age of, at that point, 20, I ate food like I had never experienced, I mean, before in my life. I had, and it wasn't just the food, it was the ingredients or the bread. And it sparked a curiosity in me and also, to some degree, a desire, a passion for these things, such that when I came back to the city, I started, like, I bought myself a little mocha. I tried to have a schedule where I could take a siesta every afternoon because I thought that was very civilized. Didn't work out that well. Didn't fit in with the lifestyle of New York City, but I tried. That was the point. And then what happened was I this is back in 1987. I was exposed to Nutella, and no one knew about Nutella back in 1987. But you know, Nutella, you would have Nutella on this kind of crusty bread with big holes, and I wanted to make crusty bread with big holes like it mattered because I had a jar of Nutella and I wanted it. So that was kind of like the impetus, was kind of like from art to food. And then there's something that's tactile, physical. You have to understand how fermentation affects the actual texture and strength and density of the dough. You have to understand how not to, for example, if you want the blob to hold its shape, not to damage it, respecting the integrity of the dough itself. So it was one of these things where, you know, it wasn't, there was actually gratification with bread in terms of giving it to people that was more profound than that of making art. Because, you know, with art, you know, the artist has to labor over it a long time, let's say. I mean, there's a similarity. And then, you know, they prepare for their big show in an art gallery, and either the show will do really well or it won't do really well. But with bread, you know, the moment you made it, you could share it with people, and it made people very happy. So I found myself, you know, making bread and giving it to friends and neighbors and people that I would meet.
You know, one thing that I found disturbing, one of my favorite childhood memories, is my mother baking bread, and she would take a roll out of the oven. My background's Sicilian, anyhow, and right away she would open it and put a Parmesan cheese and olive oil on it. And you
say
that's wrong. To me, it was immediate gratification, and I loved it. But you say that that's not a way to approach bread. It has to rest.
No.
I don't think I knew that.
No, but that's like, it's like the I mean, you know, eating food is connected to our pleasure center. Mm-hmm. Apart from it being something necessary and essential, and you know, it's like that's a great snack for a kid, or a great, like,
oh yeah,
our dinner. Yeah, that's amazing.
So now, I mean, how much of this no need bread theory was just from what you discovered? But you are heavy into research.
Well, I did, you know, kind of figure it out intuitively, and in the sense, I was asked by a chef named Cesare Casella, for the James Beard Foundation to do he was doing a menu based on Apicius, right? The first cookbook. And so he was doing a bunch of dishes, and I had already been influenced by and familiar with that book because it's just so profound to read how the culinary arts were evolved in ancient Rome, and also this the incredible variety of this technique and materials, ingredients, many ingredients that don't even exist in modern Italian cookery. So I was, I pondered like, well, if they were making bread in ancient Rome, and I had already figured this method out, it definitely had to be a no-knead dough, or it had to be, and I didn't even call it a no-knead dough. It was really more my own particular way of making bread. Oh, it's Mark Bittman is responsible for the association with the term no-knead. But the idea was, I noticed, in the practice of making bread in Florida back in 1991, 92, 90, yeah, 90, the beginning of 92, 91, 92, I noticed that when I added flour and water together, the dough formed beautifully. But the second I started working the dough, it began to fall apart, and almost as if it was like it wouldn't hold together. And I didn't understand what was happening chemically with the water and the dough. And it was one of those things that for another generation, people used to say you couldn't make good bread in Florida. Do you remember that? Or a
Oh,
good bagel.
no. I didn't
People
know
used to
that.
always say because, and there was a legitimate reason, which was there were very high levels of magnesium sulfates, I believe, in the water,
Oh.
which again act as a kind of like a fermentation catalyst, but not in a good way, by causing the flour to produce or the dough to produce excessive quantities of an enzyme called alpha amylase very early on in the dough. And that was one of the reasons why so many bakers had been frustrated. But now the water in Miami, let's say, because we have a Sullivan Street bakery in Miami as well,
Okay.
yeah, we that problem has been resolved, because I think the federal government has been trying to standardize drinking water throughout the country. It might even be where some major water issues have come about and come to light in the news, in part because the government was trying to do something they thought was good, but they didn't realize, what.
Well, you never
Yeah.
know what's in the
The water
food.
now in
I mean,
Florida is.
I got really upset when I found out that they tested in there these high levels of lead in Cocoa Puffs
Yeah, the federal
because
government has to now
you
try
know
to.
why?
Yeah,
Because
wonder.
they planted the cacao they planted it along highways.
Yeah, fascinating.
And that's
And it picks up from the fuel.
yeah.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. So, well, you very systematically went through all this process of getting to experience and learning and exploring bread baking and so on. And then you took this great leap of faith and opened your own bakery. That must have been a stunning development in your life.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of like serendipitous. It was 1992. I had just, I was at my 36th job that year. I had 37 jobs total in 1 year. I'm very proud of the fact that I was able to bullshit or was able to bullshit my way into jobs that I was totally not qualified for or take jobs that I was overqualified for and then quit because I was a
Bored.
self-absorbed, yeah, or a self-absorbed 20-something-year-old. But I
Yeah.
ended up, job 36 was working at Amy's Bread in Manhattan. She had just opened up, and I had gotten my job, without no resume to my name that I could really use, in terms of like handing out flyers on 6th Avenue for a protean version of Kinko's or something, or working at some co as a as a whatever studying barista for another protein version of like Starbucks or something, you know. But I ended up job 36 was with Amy, and I loved it, and it was a really great experience for me. Except all I did was shape bread, and
yeah.
That was my entire job. It was a 14-hour day of shaping dough, anywhere from 12 to 14 hours. Things were different back then, and it really wasn't, to me, work because I enjoyed it. It was like I got to get paid for doing my hobby. But eventually, I got tired of working at that location, and a customer of Amy's, a caterer, who recommended that I check out this restaurant on 46th Street called Joe Orso, that they might be interested. Somehow, I guess he knew that they were interested in hiring a baker. And so I knocked on the door, and then I went in, I think, on my own. I went into the restaurant at 4 a.m. in the morning. I'd somehow convinced them to let me show them what I could do before hiring me. Again, things were different then. And I went in for 2 days or 3 days and made the best bread I could make out of their pizza oven.
Okay.
And I remember putting pans of water on top of the ribbon burners while the oven was while the bread was in the oven. No, it worked. It worked. It totally worked. I kind of futzed with the oven, and I ended up, you know, making these really beautiful loaves of bread. And then after the third day, they're like, yeah, we'll hire you.
Good.
And it was like, and I got paid, and that's back then. Whoa, back then, I got paid, this is 1992, I got paid $21 an hour.
Oh,
which back then was a lot of money.
Yeah, good money.
Yeah, so I was able to have my dream life, because I really wanted to be an artist, of making bread for 3 days a week at a restaurant. And then I get the other 2 days to, like, or the other 4 days to play artist, or, you know, whatever, my Williamsburg life. That was my Williamsburg period. Little did I know that Williamsburg was going to become a thing. I had no idea. But that was my period of Williamsburg. And my investor, the guy that I ended up, who ended up investing in the bakery, the owner of Orso, Joe Allen, just didn't see Williamsburg. He just thought it was a toxic waste dump. So anyway, it's interesting.
Well, so your basic concept, I mean, it was simple. You know, can you just kind of summarize it? And then we'll talk about how you've refined it over the years. Your basic concept.
The basic concept of a no-knead dough, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And thank you. The basic concept is that you combined all the dry ingredients together. I mean, there's like a gazillion versions of putting dough together, of building a dough. But you combine all the dry ingredients, the salt, sifted in the flour, we have the convenience of powdered yeast, dry yeast, and then you basically combine the dry ingredients sifted together with water as quickly as possible, and then you allow the kind of a network of protein to form naturally as the dough begins to rise through fermentation. And then the other aspect of this dough is that the quantity of yeast is nominal, so that you really experience more the flavor of the grain rather than the byproduct of the flavor of adding lots of yeast. So my no-knead method, using a minuscule quantity of yeast and doing a fermentation period between 12 and 24 hours, creates a bread that tastes more of grain than anything else. So you really taste the byproduct of fermentation and the flour.
Yeah. No, the first, my first reaction when I read your theory about this when you first issued this concept in a cookbook was the thing that I loved the most about making bread was the kneading.
Well,
you know what I mean? I mean,
I think people have replaced, now people have replaced kneading with folding because I don't believe that it makes more sense. While dough can be mechanically kneaded together mechanically using lots of energy, physical energy, for a short period of time, you can end up with a as good or better finished product, finished bread texture, if you just fold the dough. So folding is, you know, like the sort of like most kind of popular method for, we don't want to call it kneading dough, but folding dough. And it kind of makes sense that, you know, bread making, kind of leavened bread, breads made with some form of leavening through fermentation, were made this way because, you know, human beings aren't, it's common sense. We kind of just like look at materials and see how they react, and then play with them, and then in experimenting and play, we end up creating technique or method.
Right.
You know, like no one can own that. It's so long as we're all alive, and kind of putting our thumbprint on it or our imprint on it. Experiencing it, the more hands-on something, the more discoveries are made. And so, you know, there are now all these people who are expert no-kneaders, expert dough folders, and obviously by the popularity online of, you know, kind of bread baking stuff, it's kind of cool. I mean,
really good. I mean, you're so visually oriented that it's not a surprise that you have quite a few series of techniques in pictures so that you're not leaving big holes in people's understanding.
Oh,
and
you
also... Yeah, go ahead.
No, please. I'm sorry, Anna.
No, I was going to say, you also... you've been around people doing this for such a long time that you anticipate the ghastly things, mistakes that they can make. You anticipate that and warn about them in your directions, in your instructions. So
yeah,
I think
would,
that, go ahead.
Yeah, but I would say that, like, you know, but to some degree, learning necessitates doing things wrong. And sometimes, that's an experiment, right? Try to
yeah.
do something. I mean, obviously that, as long as you're not going to hurt yourself in the process, but it's like, you know, when I work with other people, I mean, I used to tell, explain to bakers, not that I don't explain to them, but to get to a certain end result, there are innumerable variations or pathways to get there. There's like 1,000 recipes for a million recipes for any particular loaf of bread. But in terms of, you know, at least with my book and my technique, and it's very, it's a lot of other writers have like, use it now, you know, be it the kneading or the folding or whatever.
Yeah.
It's intuitive. It's very. It makes sense. It's a system. It's almost like it kind of makes sense that that's how humans have always made bread. When you think about the miracle of bread itself and the fact that a couple thousand for maybe 8,000 years, anywhere between 8 to 14,000 years. Yeah. The practice of the cultivation of, you know, Wheat's
Yeah,
ancestors.
you branch out into this other thing, which, I mean, I kind of closed my mind about all the different flowers because it goes on forever. I mean, I've reviewed books that have every imaginable flower, included, and they all require different kind of techniques and cooking times and so forth. But you expand your recipes to include various types of bread. I was particularly interested in your barley and miso bread, which I thought was rather innovative.
Yeah, that was the result of a trip my wife and daughter made to the Orkney Islands in Scotland. And they grow a grain there, and also the fact that barley is one of these super, super, super ancient grains that humans have been consuming for tens of thousands, over 10,000 years, most likely, if not longer. And it's also, associated with our good friend, our, spirits and beer and whiskey and all these other things. But they have a type of barley there called Brayer meal. It's an ancient barley that supposedly only grows on the island of Orkney. And I
Really?
loved its flavor so much. I brought a bag of it back with me to New York and began to mill it as flour, because it's like I bought it as like split oats, like almost like cut, not ground. And I began to experiment with it in a bread dough, in part for this new book. And it just kind of the flavor of miso seemed to work really well. And then there's also, there's a lot of enzymes in barley flour that also kind of enhance fermentation as well. And that's kind of where it came from.
And McGee seems to approve of all of your experimentations.
Well, oh, I hope so. I
Yeah, he
hope
seems to. You have some descriptions of how these recipes developed. It gives you some, it gives the reader some idea of how the ideas form in your mind.
Well, but I mean, you
This.
can also, I mean, this is the irony of it all, is that you could go online and ask AI, any of the various AI things, to come up with a no-knead bread using any ingredient, and it will generate for you a recipe that might actually work. And in some cases, I tested this out as well. And in some ways, I mean, they work, I can assure you that none of the recipes that I created were through
Yeah, how
that
about
means.
Jones Beach bread? That you really kind of flew a little out of the coop with that one.
No, to me that well that what that to me is a very it makes sense that that I would say poor Neapolitans probably just used ocean water to make their famous super salty pizza dough, because the quantity of salt in Neapolitan pizza dough is approximately that would be the level of as if you just added seawater to the dough to make dough. And so that's kind of where that notion came from. And then when I came up with that recipe for the book, it was about also getting people to notice the ocean and look at the sea, and also just to really reflect on how primal bread baking is. Yeah, you can grab
Yeah.
ocean water and put it in your dough, and it makes phenomenal bread. I mean, granted, I'm using a paper filter to take out some of the whatever particulates that are in it, but you don't need to. There's no law. Hopefully, there's no like toxins in the. Hopefully, it doesn't taste like.
The one bread that I really was tempted to try is a goji berry pistachio bread.
Yes. Again,
Where did that come from? Where in your
Well,
head did that come from?
I during the pandemic, this is a true story, I was like snacking on goji berries and pistachios. Like there was no, like it was going out of
Yeah.
season. And I felt like they're like a friendly couple. And I was also thinking about, nostalgia for creative breads or unusual breads or novelty breads, like in the day of, like I was inspired by James Beard's Beard on Bread, Once Upon a
Oh, yeah,
Time.
right.
And like when I was started baking, that book really captured my imagination, and I tried baking all these different breads from it. I think I had bought the book from Kitchen Arts and Letters because I asked Knott Waxman, what book should I buy on bread baking? I want to learn how to bake bread. And he gave me like five different books to buy. That was one of them. Another one of them was The Italian Baker by Carol Field. And then eventually he pointed me to these like really heavy duty textbooks that I still refer to if I'm having a technical issue, like a science type book.
Yeah, well, you use science a great deal in this, but if you didn't have your culinary sensibility and also your visual referencing, which you use a lot, it makes me think of when I was trying to figure out my paternal grandmother's recipe for a Sicilian. It's kind of like a deep fried donut called sfinge, which
Oh,
you should.
sfinge, yeah, they're amazing. That's so
Yes.
delicious.
Well, I mean, she never had any recipes written down, and she was trying to get this to me, and I would ask questions, and she began to think I was retarded. I'd
Well, I
say,
mean,
like,
and
how long do you need? How long do you do this for? And she'd say, until it's right.
until it's
That would
right.
be.
Yeah, but it's funny when you practice certain recipes and you just do it over and over again, they're not recipes, they're like rituals, they're routines. They're like I make I have a little dinky oven on a trailer, like a 1 meter. I can bake 10 kilos of dough at a time, right? 10 kilos, 9 kilos at a time.
Good.
And it's this tiny little oven. It's horrible. It doesn't work that well, but I make it work. And I like once a week I'll make a large, especially if I'm outside the city, I'll make a large batch of bread. But I make it entirely via no knead and folding. There was a reason why I answered the question this way.
I'm trying to wait till you get to
My
the
thought, Anne. So sorry.
Yeah, I was reading your pizza recipes. Nobody ever does the Sicilian pizza that my family made.
Yeah.
It's I mean, it's just regular pizza dough, but it doesn't get very high. It's higher than regular pizza dough, which is why it's called pizza alta.
Yeah.
But they just poke their fingers and thumbs in it and poke onions and anchovies into it and bake it.
It's the best. It's really, yeah, I mean, like this, Sicily is all about, at least for me, Sicily is all about, it's such a melting pot of
Well,
influence.
it is, yeah.
It's really the most, I mean, I don't think of, when I think of Sicily, I think of Sicily as a separate country from Italy.
Oh, well, I went to school in Florence. Boy, they didn't think it was Italian at all.
Well, yeah, Sicily,
So
it's totally different.
the Sicilians think that about Sicily too.
Yeah, and they're right. Like one of the few places where everything you eat, including the prosciutto di Parma, was made in Sicily. I mean, everything is made there. Nothing is made off the island, Every when you eat out at a restaurant, yeah, they don't import much at all.
No, they're having a terrible drought problem. Is it the opposite? Too much rain? I can't remember. But the climate is not cooperating. It used to be just the breadbasket of Rome.
Yeah.
But the other thing is I never see this recipe for my family called scotcha.
Yeah, no one makes. No one makes. Yeah, I didn't. I didn't. I mean, I like scotcha. Scotcha is really hard to make, really well.
Yeah, we made it all the time.
Yeah, it's good. It's like a lasagna. It's like a lasagna made from bread dough, kind of. You know.
I'm not sure about that, but well, I know what you mean by that. You know. Well, you know, listeners, this book is like not just about this one technique or concept. There are all these side issues that Jim addresses with different types of pizza and different types of sandwiches, and which I found was very interesting, the art of the sandwich.
Yeah.
And I don't recall that you said anything much about that in your first book.
No, it wasn't the focus. I think when the book came out, it was several years after the publication of the recipe. The recipe, of course, was, I think, 2006, November 8th or 7th, Election Day. But, you know, I kind of wanted to include some of, like, some ideas. Obviously, I could have done another 1,000 variations of recipes creatively, you know. But my editor, you know, recommended.
They always do that. Editors always do that. But actually, our next interview is a book that's so thick that I had to get help carrying it. It's into the studio.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess there is a rationale behind limiting the size of
the editor
recipes.
Yeah, the editor always feels like they're captain of the ship. And they feel like they know better than the author, what the public really wants, and then editors are only thinking, unfortunately, I mean, they're thinking about lots of different things. They're thinking about the career of the author. I think they mean well, but they are definitely like, kind of, yeah, they mean well. That's all I can say.
Yeah,
about.
Well, there have been a few exceptional, like, what's her name? Who published Julia Child for the first time. What was her name? The publisher, editor.
Editor. I had Maria Guarna Shelley, who is amazing.
Oh, yeah, right. She's great. Yeah. Is she alive?
No, she passed away.
Yeah, so many good people have.
She ate too much bread.
I don't know if she ate. But she's very,
very important. You snuck in a few things so that readers or book buyers would not necessarily even expect, like your personal recipe for aioli, a wonderful recipe for spicy mustard. Artichoke confit. I mean, this is a treasure trove.
Yeah, the artichoke is phenomenal.
Yeah, and potato omelet, which I never see a recipe for that, and I love potato omelets.
Yeah, well, it's like an easy, you know, like something that someone, I mean, I'm saying that someone's already, I mean, everyone does, like, in terms of content online, like the idea of just baking. You know, basically heating up a pan, a cookie sheet or a pizza sheet and a pizza pan and, you know, a mixture of cooked potatoes and onions and eggs on it, you know, and you just bake it in the oven. I mean, it's like, it's not like, it's the kind of stuff that, like, kind of is like, has been online for the last 10 years or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't even know, like, how the world online and how long the world has been online. Remember when Twitter started, but everything after Twitter is just a blur, you know? I remember AOL. I remember AOL.
I'm looking at, I actually still have AOL mail on my laptop.
But I never embraced, I guess, unfortunately for me, I never embraced social media as like my focus at the onset of my business. And to my credit, I probably would have said things that I would be incredibly embarrassed about.
It's not my
today.
Favorite thing. I mean, just suffice it to say that in our neighborhood newsletters are not my favorite thing either. All they do is complain.
Yes, I think,
but to give some idea of the reach of this book, I just want to mention a panino, which is an Italian sandwich, PMB for pancetta, mango, and basil. So yeah. you're gonna have a hard time finding anything that creative edge faster than that, unless it's the ramp, which was another one. And I love your name. How about the speckaroni?
I like the speckaroni. But the PMB is a really fun sandwich to make. I mean, obviously, you know, but you know. Obviously the type of mango you use is important, the quality of either the pancetta or the bacon, but you could always substitute something that's not like, that's a meat replacement or something, even though, or maybe some type of like a meat replacement made out of mushroom, I guess, you could, you know. But it's a fun sandwich, you know, spicy.
Yeah, well, Jim Leahy, you're fun in general, and your work is so, I don't know how to describe it. It's very creative and artistic, as well as very precise. And you won't go wrong with this book, listeners. Again, the author is Jim Leahy, and it's My Bread, and it's the 15th anniversary edition, and there were 13th. Is it 15th or 13th? 15th.
15th.
15th anniversary edition. And it's hard to believe that much time has passed.
I cannot believe.
Well, we need to talk more often, Jim Leahy.
Absolutely. You're in Philly, aren't you?
No, I'm in Pittsburgh.
Oh, nice.
I used to be in Philadelphia, but I'm not now. I'm in Pittsburgh.
I would love to visit you in Pittsburgh at some point. I've never been.
Well, you know what? I mean, people disparage Pittsburgh, but when I see stuff going on in some other cities, I give great thanks that there is a solid core of people who want to enjoy life in Pittsburgh.
my good friend and fellow baker, Rick Easton, is from Pittsburgh.
Rick makes the best pizza. I love it.
I agree. He's amazing.
Yeah. No, he's wonderful. I haven't talked to him in a long time, but and I haven't talked to her either. But I just couldn't get over how wonderful his pizza was. So I loved it. Hated when he left Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. Okay, Jim. Do not let it be this long between talks.
I agree. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
I loved it. Loved it. Love talking to you. Love your book. It's a keeper. It's going into my library.
Oh.
So thank you so much, Jim Leahy.
Thank you, man. Take care. Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.